This is RÚV English Radio with Darren Adam, daily English language radio from Iceland's national broadcaster, RÚV.
Hello, it's RÚV English Radio. My name's Darren Adam. Thanks very much for your company today. I'm not sure we've ever had the same guest on the service on two consecutive episodes, but that happens today. Jelena Čirić is with me, the journalist, but of course also a member of the choir Cleather, who performed last night at Wales of Iceland in Reykjavik, and we did a show about that on Friday. You can still find that on the website. So it would be remiss of me not to start by saying, how did the show go last night?
Oh, it went great. Thank you for asking. It's such a special venue, Wales of Iceland. I really recommend checking it out if you haven't been there, because it's just, yeah, they've got these life-size replicas of the whales just kind of hanging from the ceiling in this huge space. Mm. And the choir was kind of underneath the whales singing like voices from the deep. And yes. We had a great turnout, so it was really wonderful to
How
sing.
Were the acoustics for that? Because I know I asked you on Friday if perhaps those fiberglass whales would do something strange to the sound. Did they?
They were great. It's maybe not as resonant as you would expect, considering the size of the space, but still quite kind of echoey in a nice way. It felt very nice to sing there as a choir.
Okay, so journalist hat on now.
Yes, I'm switching hats, taking off the musician hat, putting on the journalist hat.
For an episode of The Week in Iceland, lots to talk about. We start with the cleaning wage dispute, which you will have heard a lot about over the last few days. This concerns the cleaning company staff who've been threatened with an arbitrary, it seems to me, a reduction in their wages. A lot of fury about this, not just from those workers, but from unions as well. Not a story that's going away.
No, I don't think so. And it's kind of a story that we've heard in different forms, I think, in recent years, in terms of the vulnerability of foreign workers, particularly workers that maybe speak, certainly don't speak Icelandic in many cases, maybe speak limited English as well and have limited access to just knowing about their rights.
Yeah.
So the reporters have been saying that 75% of cleaning company employees in Iceland are women and 78% are of foreign origin. So we're talking about a sort of doubly marginalized group, really, within society that we already know has a history of wage theft and their rights being violated. And according to a study that was done in 2023, cleaning staff were more likely to have their rights violated in the workplace repeatedly, more likely to be in difficult financial situations, etc. So the unions in the last collective agreement had really tried to address this group specifically by instituting wage hikes for cleaning staff in particular. And it seems like the company's response, rather than going on board with this, has been to try to avoid implementing these hikes and in some cases actually lowering wages of cleaning staff.
But who isn't angry about this? I mean, I don't see how, if that's what's happened, if the companies may have a different view, but if that's what's happened, who doesn't get angry about this? Who doesn't look at these people having already, by you know, comparative standards, very low wages cut even further? Who doesn't get furious about this?
That's a good question. I think it's a group that's easy to overlook, maybe because it's not a very visible industry. And so one of the things that's happening now in response to this reporting is that the unions are calling on municipalities and state authorities that are hiring, that are working with these cleaning companies that have been accused of wage theft, to cut their contracts with these companies. So the unions have been pointing out that if state institutions and public institutions are working with these companies, then they also bear responsibility to ensure that these employees are fairly compensated and treated well.
And it's a way of taking a lead on the issue, I suppose, isn't it? You've got Vilhjálmur Birgisson, who's the chair of the Federation of General and Special Workers in Iceland, who on Friday said, "I will never believe that Kristrún Frostadottir, the relatively new prime minister, and Heiðar Björg Hilmisdóttir, who's the chair of the Association of Icelandic Municipalities, who identify as social democrats, would allow the state and the municipalities to engage in business with cleaning companies that may be exploiting their workers." So there's pressure there, right on the very top, to say, well, okay, as government, as councils, essentially, as the state, if you will, we can take a lead here and try to not use these companies in the hope that they change their practices.
And I think it's an opportunity as well for these people in leadership positions, especially women in leadership positions. Mm. I mean, there's been so much talk and even international reporting on the new government, the new governing coalition that has three female leaders in Iceland. And, you know, even globally, it's kind of been reported on as this incredible thing. And I think it's an opportunity for these women in positions of power to show that they're not excluding, you know, women on the other end of the scale, foreign women who are in many cases being exploited.
The government of the Valkyries, as you may have seen it.
That's
mean.
Right,
so, they gave themselves that name, we should say.
Yeah.
In the same way that I think I'm right in saying the five female leaders of the parties who are hoping to form a coalition to run Reykjavik City Council, I think they gave themselves the name of the Spice Girls as well. So that's not sexist, cheap reporting. That's naming that they chose themselves. I think I'm right in saying that anyway.
Yeah. So it is also another interesting thing that's happening right now, where we're seeing so much female leadership.
Yes.
The Bishop of Iceland and
the
Police Commissioner, the President of Iceland, all women currently. And so it's an interesting thing that sort of happened. Interesting to explore kind of why is now the time that, you know, women are kind of coming forward into these positions, what still needs to be done.
And 75% of cleaning staff, also female, related to all of this in the way that we've described, I think.
Absolutely.
Let's turn to Sungva Kepnin. I was there at the RVK studios in Gouverness on Saturday for the second semi-final. I'm going to be commentating again in English on the final, which is this coming Saturday. Details of all of that to come. We're going to have it on ruv.is. As usual, you can watch that anywhere in the world. But also this year, we're going to be on YouTube. So wherever you happen to be, it might be easier if you're watching that on a TV that's got YouTube built in, whatever. Both streams will be available to watch in Iceland and outside of Iceland as well. Last year, we had viewers on every continent on Earth, apart from Antarctica. Unless there were some researchers and or penguins who were watching, you didn't get in touch with us. Mm-hmm. We had viewers everywhere. Is this something you follow? Well, you never know. Is this something that you follow? I mean, pop your music hat back on for
a minute,
I guess.
Certainly not as closely as you do, I'm sure. but it's something that moving to Iceland, I definitely have followed more than previously. And it's interesting to see how much of a big deal it is here in Iceland, both Sungva Kepnin and Eurovision. However, it does feel like it's kind of dwindled a bit in recent years. I mean, last year there was a big call to pull Iceland out of Eurovision, which is obviously what Sungva Kepnin is the lead up to, due to Israel's participation. And this year those calls have somewhat continued, but they seem quieter or at least less reported on. So maybe it's just in my circles, it feels like there's less attention on Sungva Kepnin than there has been in some years.
There's also been this year a decision that was made right at the outset that whoever, you know, that this was the way that we were going to select Iceland's entry for Eurovision. Last year, because of those issues that you described, the two were separated. We had Sungva Kepnin, which was a national singing competition within Iceland, which then could have become, and in fact did, as it turned out, the way that we selected Iceland's Eurovision entry. But that break didn't happen this year. We're back to where we've been since 1986, which is that Sungva Kepnin exists to pick Iceland's Eurovision entry. So that's baked in this year. That's not up for debate. We know that whoever wins on Saturday will be representing Iceland at Eurovision. That said, not two great years for Iceland at Eurovision in the last 2 years.
No.
Hera Björk, who I think did a fantastic job, did actually have Iceland's worst ever performance at Eurovision last year. And Delia, another great song, another great singer the year before, didn't do a lot better. So we're coming out of 2 years of pretty bad performances. I don't mean bad performances, but bad results. Bad results.
In terms
poor
of
results.
Placement on the...
So I wonder whether, you know, third time lucky, I suppose. If we say the first two were a bit unlucky, the six finalists have been confirmed. I don't know whether you pay enough attention to even be familiar at all with the songs.
I haven't this year, I have to admit. It changes from year to year. Some years I feel like I hear them a lot more and I take the time to listen, and other years less so.
Well, I think we have six great songs. I think any of them would do a great job. I'm not going to say which one I think is most likely to do a good job, and you're not going to be biased either because you haven't heard them. So we're fine on that. We are clear. Sungforkettan in 2025, the final taking place this Saturday. As I say, English language commentary available if you want to listen to that. We'll have sign language commentary as well. And, of course, the whole thing available on the TV on Ruv. But details of all of that to come throughout the course of the week. Now, we're heading into spring. We very much have a reminder of winter every time we get into our cars and drive everywhere, because the potholes on the roads in Iceland are truly appalling. Bad enough here in the capital, but if you get up to the west and into the Westfjords, we have the tar, the bitumen, if you like, literally bleeding out of the roads onto the tires, causing real damage. Really hard to drive around in places where cars are even more essential than they are in Reykjavik.
That's right. And I mean, this is an ongoing issue that we've seen in Iceland. And I mean, I could compare it to where I grew up, Canada, in the sense that compared to the surface area of the country, I mean, we've got this huge country and we've got a relatively small population compared to the size, which means that there's a really small tax base considering the numbers of kilometers of road we need to connect one place to another and to connect the whole country. So how do you take this small tax base and ensure that there's enough money to build and maintain this huge road network compared to the number of people who use it? And I mean, now I suppose the users are growing in terms of there's more and more tourists driving around, but certainly in areas off of the Ring Road, like we're talking about in the Westfjords, Snæfellsnes Peninsula in the west.
Well, even chunks of Route 1, though, even chunks of the
Even
Ring
chunks
Road.
Of Route 1, that's true as well, that are maybe less less busy than the little south strip or around Reykjavik. How do you ensure that those areas are funded adequately to keep the roads in a decent condition? And of course, you know, for a tourist, this kind of affects their vacation maybe, but for the people who live in these areas, it's a question of safety, everyday safety, getting to work, getting to school, getting to a hospital when they have an emergency.
But we know it can be done, because I first came to Iceland in 1998. That was our first ever visit. And we drove around Route 1 as it was then. And about a third of it was still gravel. There wasn't even tarmac down. I'm thinking of the stretch kind of roughly between Hupen and Ilstadir. A big chunk of the east was still gravel, and sections that would switch between tar and gravel very quickly. In fact, there used to be signs up saying, you know, gravel ahead. And I think in some areas off the Ring Road, that's still the case. You might still find those signs. But you used to see them a lot, because you don't want to hit a section of gravel coming off tar at, you know, whatever speed you're doing in fifth or sixth gear. So, and all of that's now changed. All of that's now tar. So it can be done when there's a will. The roads can be improved. And I think we're now at the stage where, for locals and visitors alike, when you've got this kind of damage being done to people's cars, when you've got this sort of insecurity that people feel, you know, are they going to be able to complete their journey from point A to point B? We need that kind of national effort again, I think, to get these roads fixed.
Certainly, and it's definitely something that does take a national effort and national coordination. And I know right now there's a sort of reorganization of the funding system for the roads that's taking place because a lot of the road maintenance is funded, well, most of it through taxes that are imposed on gasoline, petrol. But because more and more cars are becoming electric in Iceland, more people are using electric cars, fewer people are using cars that rely on fossil fuels. And that means that that revenue is shrinking. And so now a new tax has been implemented, a sort of kilometer tax on vehicles that's supposed to make up for that that lost revenue. But it's something that's still in process, I think. And it's something that, you know, the Road and Coastal Administration has been saying for many years that they're underfunded, that they need more funding in order to maintain the roads. So it's difficult to say whether it's a question of simply more funding is needed, political will, or whether people in the countryside are kind of being neglected in certain ways.
I think they would rightly feel that that is the case. I know that the kilometre charge is intended to be, I think it's meant to be revenue neutral. I mean, at least for drivers, if you do the average kilometrage, which is, I think, about 15,000 kilometres a year, if you do that, then you'll probably end up paying about as much as you did. I mean, unless you had some, you know, 6-litre gas guzzler that was obviously using a lot more petrol. I mean, you might end up you know, better off if that's the case, if you're paying per kilometre rather than according to the amount of gasoline or petrol that you consume. That's all to come out in the wash. I know that petrol prices have not yet fallen. The duty's not come off petrol. So that kilometre charge, as you say, still in the process of being implemented. It will be interesting to see if it, you know, ultimately generates more money and if that money is spent on improving the roads. I think it's going to need more than that, to be honest. And I'm not sure that the intention of it anyway is to generate money to improve the roads. Okay, let's also talk about something which affects a lot of people at this time of year, but not me. I'm the opposite. Akureyri University is trying to determine why people in Iceland are less sad, that is less SAD, less susceptible to seasonal affective disorder, which usually, if it does affect people, does so during the winter, when it's dark, when the sun doesn't rise till 11 o'clock in the morning and doesn't set until 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Is that something that affects you?
I think the darkness certainly affects me, probably not to the point of having seasonal affective disorder, but I certainly feel a difference in the wintertime, and kind of by January, February, can hardly wait for the, you know, morning light to return, right, where you can wake up and it's bright already, you know.
Are you from a particularly northern part of Canada?
No, I grew up in Toronto, so it's quite a lot brighter. Of course, we notice a difference between winter and summer. The days are certainly longer, noticeably longer in the summer. But even in the darkest point of winter,
yes,
because of daylight savings, you still have full daylight from maybe 8 in the morning or so.
Okay.
So it's certainly, yeah, and until about 5 o'clock or so.
I love the Icelandic winter. I love when it's dark until 11 o'clock in the morning and the sun doesn't go down till 3 o'clock. I would have it like that all year round. I think it's fantastic. I get so much more done. I'm much more awake. I don't have to stick tinfoil up on the windows so that it's possible to sleep at night without the sun creeping in. I wouldn't say I go as far as to have summer seasonal affective disorder, but I'm much less happy in the summer. I'm much grumpier in the summer. I don't like the sunlight. And I mean, I don't like the warmth either. So this is not a bad place to be. At least it's not too hot in Iceland.
So you found your dream. You found your paradise, really, here in Iceland.
I found my dream climate. If we could just keep the sun out of the sky in the summer.
I have to agree in terms of when it does get really bright in June and, you know, we have sunlight around the clock, that I do find that difficult in other ways. Certainly in terms of just feeling really rested, getting a proper sleep where you feel like you sleep deeply. Even with blackout curtains, I feel like it still does affect you. Have this, you wake up and you feel like you've already had coffee. You're sort of a bit wired all the time. And I've certainly heard from people as well that time of year can be difficult because there's also a sort of societal expectation that everybody's happy.
Yes.
Do you find that as somebody who loves the winter?
Well, what happens is, and this is true here, it was true back in the UK as well, if it's sunny, people say, oh, what a lovely day. No, it's hideous. I hate it. You know, and of course you can't then, what I would like to do in the depths of, for me, the heights of December, I'd love to say to someone when it's dark and cold, what a lovely day. But if you say that, people look at you like you're a certifiable lunatic. So it is partly about being out of step, I think, a little bit.
Yeah. So why do you think people are less susceptible to seasonal affective disorder here?
I don't know. That's what the Akureyri University is trying to find out. They're going to get some volunteers and I think place electronic helmets on their head, which detect what the brain is doing. I don't know what the answer is to that question, because there are plenty of other, you know, populated places at this latitude which will have as much daylight or as little daylight. I mean, Newark in Greenland is at exactly the same latitude. There are a brace of cities across North America and across Europe as well that are this far north and have the same issue, I suppose. I don't know what the answer is.
Yeah, I mean, my background's not in science, so no. I mean, the only kind of speculations I can make are more kind of societal, whether maybe it's the proximity to nature here, that people can get outdoors more easily, that there's something about the lifestyle, the swimming pools, certainly.
Swimming. That's it. That's
you know, that's where the mind goes first, is just having a good soak in a hot tub, and, you know, that does wonders for
weather.
For the mental health.
People
certainly
still don't believe that here in Iceland it can be minus 15 degrees and that you step outside and, you know, in any circumstances you step outside, but you step outside when you're wet, having just been in the shower, and then you go into the hot pots, which are at 38 degrees pretty much all year round. But that's the reality of it. I think you've hit upon it. That's the reason. So we could we'll contact the university and say, save your research fund, spend it on something else. It's swimming.
Yeah.
And outdoor swimming at that. Okay. Let us turn to another issue which has exercised a lot of people. And this is the airport in the city centre. This is the Reykjavik domestic airport, not the one that you fly into if you fly into the country. It's at Keflavik, even though your boarding pass might say Reykjavik confusingly. Mm-hmm. This is the smaller airport. It's extremely handy if you're flying to Akureyri or Eyjafjörður or Ísafjörður around the country. I think from that perspective, it's a great airport. But it also saves lives because it's used for air ambulances to transport people from all around the country. However, it also is in a part of the city, or very close to a part of the city, called Öskjuhlíð, which sees a forest. There aren't many trees in Iceland, are there?
No.
So this city centre forest is protected and wants to be protected by a lot of people. However, the trees, some of them are too high, which causes flight safety issues. So that's where we are. We've got a battle between what the airport does, what it needs to do, and the height of the trees that people want to protect. What happens next?
Yeah, and I mean, just to give a little bit more context, I mean, the city airport in Reykjavik has been contentious ever since it was established, actually. It was actually the U.S. Army, or I believe the British Army, actually, who was here first, that chose this location for the airport. And the city authorities, even at that time, were actually against this location. And as the city's grown, the people who live in the city feel like it's a huge space that could be used for housing, for just making the city more dense, et cetera, et cetera. On the other side of this argument, it is actually a great location in terms of flight safety, wind currents, that sort of thing, which are obviously very important in terms of where you place an airport, especially in windy Iceland.
Yes.
And then, of course, the air ambulances, the medical flights that come from all over the country and ensure that people in the countryside can have as quick as possible access to emergency services here in the capital. So you've got these two sort of sides of the argument. Of course, it's hard to argue with, you know, life-saving services, especially if there's no alternative available. Now, it seems like in terms of the specific issue with the trees, they've started actually cutting the trees already. So the flight paths and flight angles and all that safety looks like it will be ensured for the time being.
The number of trees that they've cut are very small compared with the initial estimates. I think there was one estimate a couple of years ago of something like 3,000 trees needing cut.
And it's been a few hundred, I believe.
It's not even that, I think. I think it's maybe 150, something like that. So a very small number so far. I think the revised estimates of the number of trees that will need to be cut is much lower than the 2,900, I believe, is the original estimate. But there's an upside, and I don't claim to be any sort of expert on such matters, but I did read that the cutting of some trees will allow light to penetrate parts of the forest which have previously been darkened, therefore, to an extent, nourishing some other trees in the forest.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's a bad thing for the forest. All forests need to be thinned at some point. So the question is whether this thinning is sort of in line with what would have happened anyway or not. I'm sure it's a little bit different, but hopefully the forest can recover and you know, grow in different ways.
Yes. That aside, I just love the speed of that airport because if I'm traveling around the country, I will often fly to Akureyri or to Eyjafjörður or whatever it happens to be. And that airport, when you go through it, speaking as someone that spent 8 years flying between London and Edinburgh pretty much every week, the speed with which you can traverse that airport, the speed with which you can turn up, park your car and then get on the plane, compared with, I don't know, any other airport anywhere, any international airport, certainly, it feels pretty liberating, to be honest.
It is very special. You walk in and you turn a corner and you're basically on the plane.
On the plane and then what, 45 minutes later after a wonderful scenic flight over the interior of Iceland. Yeah, that's the bonus, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because you usually fly low enough to be able to see the very centre of the country. You're at your destination. So I think a lot of people would miss having it in the city. There have been conversations about moving it to sort of halfway between the capital and Keflavik, somewhere out in the Reykjanes Peninsula. Talk of moving it to the north of the capital, but I think it's too windy if you sort of head towards Borgarnes. It's too windy up that way. So there are reasons to keep, certainly reasons not to keep it where it is, but also reasons to keep it where it is.
Yeah, yeah. And it's been a conscientious, contentious issue is what I meant to say,
yes.
For many years since it was really established and since this location was chosen. And so I think it's one of those controversies that's not going to go away.
No, I suspect when we discuss this on The Week in Iceland in 2035, we'll probably still be talking about whether the tree should be cut down at Ørskjelid as a consequence of the flight safety concerns. Jelena, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you for having me.
When are the Kliðr Choir going to be performing again, just to bring us back to where we came in our conversation?
Well, we don't have a concert that's coming up in the very near future because we are actually going to Skálholt for a little choir retreat a few weeks from now.
The choir camp.
Yeah, we have a yearly choir camp. We did mention that on Friday in last week's interview. And so that's kind of the next thing in our schedule is getting out of the city for a weekend, learning some new pieces and having just some nice dinners together and spending some time together as a group. And then I suppose planning the next concert, but
yes,
we'll definitely have something happening before about June, kind of the end of this semester for the choir. So
stay tuned
for that.
Watch this space, listen to this space, Jelena. Thank you very much indeed, Jelena Cherich.
Thank you so much.
Journalist joining me today to review the week in Iceland. It's Roof English Radio. My name's Darren Adam, and you can get in touch with us anytime. We're english@ruv.is.
There is more from RÚV English with all the news from Iceland in English at ruv.is/English. RÚV English Radio is a daily English language radio from Iceland's national broadcaster, RÚV.